You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Truth to Power. So the year is 1981. People in Seattle who turned on Cairo 7 News on the evening of June 1st heard a report of a violent attack. Two men had been shot in a union hall in the Pioneer Square neighborhood.
Police say the man who made it to the sidewalk was the union secretary treasurer. He was conscious when the medics arrived and taken to Harborview for emergency surgery. The man inside the office was dead at the scene.
Police the man taken to Harborview died the next day. This double murder started out looking like an internal union dispute, but the case is way more than that. We're talking intrigue worthy of a spy novel. It eventually led all the way up to a foreign dictator. Family and friends of the young men have been waging a fight for justice that's still going on almost 38 years later. Here with the story is KNKX reporter Ashley Gross. Hey, Ashley.
Hey, Gabe.
So this is a pretty straightforward story, right? This will be, you know, in and out a couple of minutes here.
Sorry, no. I'd say grab a cup of tea, settle in.
Got it. So it's some twists and turns here.
Exactly.
Okay, so who were these two young men who were killed?
Their names were Salmi Domingo and Gene Viernes. They were Filipino-American labor activists, officers in the cannery workers, Local 37. That was part of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And it represented mostly Filipino-Americans who would go up to Alaska in the summer to work in the seafood canneries. Salmi and Gene, they were both 29 when they died. They were young, you know, ambitious and charismatic guys, but they were also really different from each other. Salmi was the college-educated sophisticate.
He drove a purple Monte Carlo. He had elevator shoes.
He dressed in velvet pants and high-heel boots. He was in style at that period of time.
That's Cindy Domingo, Salmi's younger sister, and Michael Withy, a lawyer who was friends with both men. Gene Viernes came from rural Washington, and he didn't really care about how he dressed.
Gene was salt of the earth. He came from Wapato, and he wore a kind of a workman's hat.
He's quieter, a quieter person, was an inward thinker. Coming together, they formed a very dynamic duo.
So if they were so different, what made them such good friends?
They were just really committed to fighting for workers' rights and fighting for fairness. And they also really wanted to reform the union.
The union had been taken over by really what amounted to criminal elements. Tony Barroso ran the union with an iron fist and also, you know, was accused of taking bribes, getting a cut of the gambling proceeds up in Alaska.
So organized crime had a racket going on here, and the reforms that Gene and Salmi wanted to put in place that threatened to interrupt that. That really ticked off the gang known as the Tulisan Gang, and these were the guys who were running the gambling operation up in Alaska.
Oh, okay. So they were really poking the bear, huh?
Yeah, they were not afraid to challenge some entrenched and, you know, pretty dangerous guys. Shortly after that, Gene and Salmi were murdered. But Salmi survived long enough to identify the shooters. It was two members of the Tulisan Gang.
You know, Salmi, incredible courage to get outside the Union Hall with four 45 caliber bullet holes in him, watching his best friend Gene Viernes like bleed out on the union floor, hail down a fireman, and then name who shot him. Then we had to fight for justice. We had to never, ever let this go.
A few months later, the gang members were put on trial.
Two members of the Filipino Tulisan Gang were convicted of the killings. Jimmy Ramil and Ben Galoy were given life prison terms for those slayings.
So the killers are caught, but I'm guessing that this is not the end of the story?
No, it's not. Family and friends of Gene and Salmi, they had serious doubts that the murders really stemmed from this dispute with the gang. They thought somebody much more powerful had ordered the killings.
You know, I would say it took us less than 48 hours to really kind of map out who benefited from the murders, and it was always the Marcos dictatorship.
Okay, so we're back in the 1980s Philippines here. This is the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship?
Yeah, you know, some people may just remember stories of his wife Imelda and all her shoes.
You know what most people are interested in?
Mm-hmm.
Your wife's 3,000 pairs of shoes.
Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, they'd gotten rich running the Philippines. Marcos had imposed martial law for 9 years and had cracked down on the opposition. He was jailing opponents. According to Amnesty International, tens of thousands of Filipinos were tortured and about 3,000 were killed.
Okay, but why did this authoritarian strongman in the Philippines care so much about these two American labor activists?
Right. I mean, these are just two young guys here in the United States. But Gene and Selmy, they were part of this anti-Marcos group here. And Gene had traveled to the Philippines and met with a guerrilla group that was fighting the Marcos regime and with some labor leaders at a May Day celebration.
Especially because he was visible during that May Day rally. He was already targeted for surveillance.
So Gene was already on the radar of the Marcos regime. But then he and Selmy did something else that probably angered Ferdinand Marcos even more. They pushed for their union, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, at the annual convention to take a stand in support of the workers in the Philippines and to send a delegation to investigate abuses over in the Philippines. That was probably threatening to Marcos because of the, you know, possibility that trade with the U.S. would be impacted if the longshoremen took action.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So they're really going after Marcos where it hurts, it sounds like.
Right. And, you know, they knew that this was dangerous. Cindy says that they were fearful and Selmy had started to carry a gun. But no one really thought that, you know, their lives were on the line, especially here in the country where they were born.
So how would you even go about proving that Marcos was involved in the crime?
That's where it gets even more interesting. The murder weapon was found in a dumpster in West Seattle. And the owner was not someone in the Tulisan gang. It belonged to Tony Barroso, the president of the Cannery Workers Union. And that's where the link to Marcos comes. So Barroso had really admired Marcos. They had met. He had a photo hanging in his union office of him and Ferdinand Marcos shaking hands. And so family and friends of Gene and Selmy, when this murder weapon was found, they expected the King County prosecutor to charge Barroso. They thought, okay, he'll get charged, he'll flip, he'll explain the conspiracy, you know, and who ordered the murders. But the prosecutor didn't charge Barroso, at least not then.
We need our own vehicle for bringing about justice. So we designed this lawsuit against not the sovereign of the Philippines. It was called the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, gave them immunity except if they committed a tortious act or a civil wrong, which includes murdering people, in the U.S. And we named Marcos.
They're suing a foreign dictator.
Yep. And I love this part of the story. They had to serve Ferdinand Marcos with the lawsuit. So they decided to do it when he was here in the U.S. for a really important meeting.
Mr. President, Mrs. Marcos, it gives me special pleasure to welcome you to the United States.
Marcos came here for a state visit with Ronald Reagan in 1982. And the friends and family of Gene and Selmy thought, okay, here's our opportunity to, you know, serve him this lawsuit.
And that means they have to actually hand him papers physically.
Exactly. So Michael Withy says they cooked up this scheme with a friend of theirs, Bill Davis, who was a Catholic priest. And they thought this is a way to grab Marcos's attention because he's from such a predominantly Catholic country.
He got dressed up in his priest garb and waited kind of in the vestibule behind some potted plants. And there's Marcos and Imelda and his entourage kind of walking down a long hallway. And so Bill Davis kind of steps out and Ferdinand Marcos looks at him and says, "Oh, hello, Father. What can I do for you?" He says, "Here, I've got..." Davis goes, "Here, I got something for you to read." And he hands him the complaint.
So picture this. Marcos has the red carpet rolled out for him there in Washington, D.C. He's meeting the president. And at the same time, he gets handed this lawsuit that's accusing him of being involved in the murders of these two young American guys. The whole lawsuit was really novel, and they knew it. The U.S. State Department argued that Marcos had immunity as head of state, and the judge agreed and dismissed Marcos from the case. But he allowed the case against the Philippine government to go ahead.
Okay, so they're suing the Republic of the Philippines. And this was kind of a crazy time in that country, right? What was going on there when this was happening?
Right, yes, it was really crazy. So an opponent of Marcos, Senator Benigno Aquino, he had been living in exile, but he decided that he wanted to return. So as soon as he landed there at the airport and he stepped off the plane, he was gunned down. There were just massive protests, and Marcos wound up calling for an election in 1986. Aquino's widow, Cory Aquino, ran against him. Marcos declared victory, but people didn't believe it. And he wound up just having to concede and flee. He fled to Hawaii, which is significant because He was no longer head of state, and he was now in the U.S., and so the lawsuit on behalf of Jean and Selmy got new life.
The day he got off the airbase at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii, we slapped him with a subpoena, and so did U.S. Customs, and we got all Marcos's financial documents.
Those financial documents, that was like a gold mine. They discovered that Marcos's reach stretched deep into the United States, and they found that Marcos had set up a slush fund here in the U.S. to pay for all his covert intelligence operations, spying on anti-Marcos activists like Selmy and Jean. And not just that, they found the money trail that showed that Tony Barroso, the union president, and the head of the Tulisan gang had gotten paid out of the slush fund for the murders of Selmy and Jean.
Oh, wow. So that makes the link completely explicit. So Barroso, the guy whose gun turned up in a West Seattle dumpster, who was the head of the union, who was kind of connected to the gang and also kind of connected to Marcos, this brings it all together. It's clearly coming from the highest levels.
I mean, imagine finding a document like that showing the money trail. It's incredible. The judge allowed Withy to take a deposition from Marcos. So he and Selmy's widow, Terry Mast, traveled to Hawaii to depose Marcos. He was frail. He was on dialysis. He had to take a lot of breaks.
Well, I think it was really hard for Terry because there's the man that had her husband and one of her best friends, Jean, murdered, right? And for me, I was just steely determination that we're going to get this guy.
The judge allowed Marcos to be reinstated to the case. And then shortly before it went to trial, he died.
So where did that leave the lawsuit?
It proceeded against Imelda and the Marcos estate. And it went to trial in 1989 in Seattle. I asked Cindy Domingo how it felt. She said on the last day of the trial, she remembers looking around and seeing so many people there in the courthouse.
I said to myself, I said to Selmy, I said, I did my job. I carried out my commitment to you and Jean. And that for me, even if the verdict hadn't come in, in our favor, I would have been satisfied with the work that we had carried out.
So the verdict did come back in their favor? They won the case?
Yes, they won. The jury even awarded more than Withy had asked for. The jury awarded $15.1 million. They later settled for $3 million.
So they won this unprecedented case against a foreign dictator, and they got their vindication. But it sounds like that's not the end of the story either.
Correct. It's not. There's a whole other part of the case that I haven't talked about. That has to do with how much the U.S. government knew about the kind of spying that Marcos was doing here and whether the FBI and U.S. intelligence agencies had advanced knowledge of the murders. Michael Withy writes about all of this in his book. It's called Summary Execution. Now he's suing the FBI to force them to turn over documents. And a spokeswoman for the FBI in Seattle says they don't comment on ongoing litigation.
So what do you take away from this story?
What's striking to me is that Jean Viernes and Selmy Domingo were unafraid. They were just these young guys willing to, you know, challenge the status quo and fight for fairness. And they died young, but their family and friends continued that fight. And they've been working to hold powerful interests accountable, whether it's a foreign dictator or the U.S. government. They're just willing to follow this fight wherever it takes them.
Thanks, Ashley.
You're welcome.
Ashley Gross is a reporter at KNKX.